Okay, so we briefly met Avalokiteshvara last night, and then we went round and did our ritual with chanting his mantra and waving incense and all that. And I've called this work retreat Avalokiteshvara and the Creative Heart, and that's because basically, I mean, if you were just to say one thing about compassion, it's just meeting pain and being able to have a creative response to that engagement. And that is all it is, in a way. So I'm going to start with a story from the life of the Buddha. Because I think to me it just felt very important to have a sort of like an actual example of like, so what does it actually look like when someone is embodying compassion in the world? And actually, there are loads of stories of the Buddha's life, and probably an awful lot of them show him embodying compassion. But the one that I'm going to remind you of is the story of Kisa Gotami, which probably most of you are familiar with. So what's happening here is there is a young woman who's her husband has died, and she had one son. And after a certain time, her son also dies, and that's, you know, that's like the last thing that she has in the world. It's, you know, her son is the thing that is sort of keeping her in there, and she just can't accept that her son has died. And so she's clutching her child to her, and she's walking through the streets and running through the streets and asking strangers, "Can you find medicine for my son? He's ill." And then they realize she's carrying a corpse, and then they're sort of hurrying away, you know, and sort of shouting after her and saying, you know, "Get out, you know, go and leave him in the corpse yard." And then finally, somebody tells her to go and see the Buddha, and the Buddha can see that she's in a complete state. And he doesn't say, "Look, sorry, love, your son's dead." You know, he says, "So I can give you medicine for your son. Go to the nearest house and ask for mustard seed." And she sort of thinks, "Oh, great." And but the Buddha says, "There's one condition. It's got to come from a house where there's never been a death. That's the only thing." And she sort of thinks, "Oh, well, that's all right." So, you know, off she goes to the first house. And you know, there they go to get the mustard seed, and she says, "Oh, has anyone died here?" And of course they say, "Well, yes, you know, yeah, my grandfather died, my grandmother died." She thinks, "Oh, okay, no good." Next house. "No, my sister died and my daughter died, you know, a couple of years ago." And she goes to the next house, and someone says, "No, my sister died, and then my father-in-law died, and you know, and then there's the two babies." And she goes to the next house. And I find it such a moving story because, you know, she just keeps on going to the houses, and you know, who knows how many times she had to be told, "No, my relative's died, my husband's died, my daughter's died, my son died, my father, my mother." You know, how many houses, I wonder, did it take before she actually thought, "Ah, this isn't just something special that has happened to me." So then she goes back to the Buddha. And she's sort of quite different at that point, so she's calmed, and she just sits down at the Buddha's feet, and she's left her son in the charnel ground, as they did in ancient India at that time. And she just says to the Buddha, "The little mustard seed has done its work." And then she goes for refuge to the Buddha. She takes on spiritual practice, and after a certain amount of time, she becomes enlightened. And yeah, becomes one of the arahants in the Pali Canon. And I think I just really love that story because it's like that's just like the Buddha meeting another human being. And it's like the Buddha cannot make that situation okay for her. That is just not possible. You know, her son has died. That is the way it is. the Buddha can't do anything to raise him from the dead. He can't find a special medicine. But he can just respond to her with a deep kindness so that she herself is able to realize the nature of her own suffering and that it's universal and come to a completely different relationship with it. And all the Buddha is doing in that moment is truly encountering Kisa Gotami at that point, you know, where she is, and then seeing what will take her on the next step. And, you know, there might have been lots of people that maybe that next step wasn't possible for them, but for her it was. And in a way, that's all we ever need to do as well. All we need to do is respond to the person in front of us or the situation in front of us and see, can we do something? And if not, can we have a creative heart response? That is all we need to do. So I think I particularly wanted to start with that story because, in a way, I mean, Avalokiteshvara, he's a bodhisattva. And that means a being dedicated to gaining enlightenment, and not just for his own sake, but for the sake of all beings. And in a way, probably Avalokiteshvara, out of all the different Buddhas and Bodhisattvas of all different sort of types and flavours, Avalokiteshvara is most the one who represents the Bodhisattva ideal. And that's that ideal where we do not practice just for ourselves, but we also practice for the benefit of all beings. So the Dalai Lama is regarded by Tibetans as being an embodiment of Avalokiteshvara in the world. And like we can see that as being like he's regarded as embodying compassion in the world. It's like he's become so much what Avalokiteshvara is symbolically representing, that actually he is acting as Avalokiteshvara in the world to quite a great extent. And so there's a verse from the Bodhicaryavatara that apparently the Dalai Lama says to himself every day. So he says, as long as space abides and as long as the world abides, so long may I abide, destroying the sufferings of this world. It's like you couldn't have a larger ideal. And then there's us. And it's like I remember when I was first being sort of introduced to the Bodhisattva ideal, and what I remember is this was largely Vajratara in Sheffield, if those of you that know her. And, you know, I think I was in the Sheffield tea room at the Buddhist Centre, and she'd just given this sort of talk all about the Bodhisattva ideal. And I was just saying to her, I just can't go there. I can't think about it. It's just totally overwhelming. And I just remember her looking at me and saying, well, if we're not going to engage with that, then who is? So I think I'm telling you that because I'm giving this talk about compassion from the point of view of someone who really easily gets overwhelmed by looking out at suffering and thinking, I just don't know how to respond to this. But also I am someone who, you know, over time, basically I do completely consider my practice as part of the Bodhisattva ideal, and that is why I get up in the morning, if you see what I mean. And I'm still someone who gets overwhelmed by reading the news, for instance. So there's definitely no shortage of suffering in the world. I don't think anybody would attempt to argue that. And it's like there's different spheres of suffering, isn't there? Because in a way, there's the suffering that we see out in the world. You know, we see like the newspaper reports of the Paris bombings. We see refugees from Syria. I went to a fantastic event recently in Borth featuring Anne, which was all about water. And it was really moving. I mean, it was a completely amazing event. Ask her about it later. where all these different films were being projected across the street onto the front of people's houses, and there were loads of people out watching them. But there were two films in particular that I found really moving, and one of them was Anne's Sand Village of Borth, which was filmed while so she'd made this village out of sand of where she lives, and the tide was coming in and slowly washing away all these houses. And then there was another film of Fiji islanders. And these islanders, because of the rise in sea levels due to climate change, they were facing having to move their islands because, you know, they're only a very little bit out of the sea anyway, and they were just getting washed away. And that was their actual reality. It wasn't just a sand village being filmed. And it was such a great event, actually, because there was just like this, there was this sort of massiveness of climate change, but then there was also this great community spirit, and all these people stood in the street in the freezing cold and the howling wind watching these films. It was amazing. So there's certainly no shortage of suffering out in the world. But then there's also like the suffering of people we know, maybe, you know, health, depression. I'm sure all of us have a number of people in our lives that we know about having a hard time. And then there's also our own suffering, you know, mental, physical, whatever that might be. And I particularly just wanted to look at those three areas, because it's very easy to kind of ignore our own experience and to kind of think, oh, well, suffering's out there, or like, you know, what, our experience isn't real or something like that. But actually, suffering is just suffering wherever it is. It's just as real in ourselves, in our friends, in other people that we don't know, whatever, if you see what I mean. And the other suffering that I do also want to mention is the suffering of a pointless life. So there could be no wars, there could be no natural catastrophes happening, and actually if what somebody is doing with their life is something like watching third-rate TV programmes, getting drunk at weekends and going on Facebook, that is suffering. You know, there is suffering that they are not able to lead a meaningful life or move towards who they could be. And that is that's like the existential casualties. That's what Sangharakshita calls the existential casualties. So then, I suppose, what is compassion? Like, what is it when we talk about it? So, first, it's simply a response of caring. We do care about that person, that situation, ourselves in that situation. It's also active. We want to help if we can. And it's also wise, and that's very important. So true compassion would see the conditions, like the underlying conditions of what is producing that suffering. Just like with the Buddha, he saw that Kisa Gotami's suffering couldn't be solved by telling her to get medicine for her child. It could only be solved by her coming to a deeper understanding, even though it's also important to alleviate suffering on whatever level we can. So it's not possible to cultivate compassion. I always find that very cheering, actually. So really, all we can cultivate is well-wishing. All we can do is try to open to wishing others well, and to notice what opens us to being able to care about people. And then when we meet a painful situation, compassion is something that will naturally arise. It's not something that can be produced, nor should we try. It's also not a miserable emotion. So I think one of the qualities of true compassion is that there's a sort of deep connectedness to it. It's actually, there's a certain pleasure there, and that's okay. So what I'm thinking of, like an instance that I can think of very recently, was the day after the Paris bombings. And I'd heard, you know, I'd heard the news and I'd heard about the Paris bombings, and I was just feeling completely cut off from it, you know, totally alienated, and just feeling like this is totally overwhelming, you know, this is all happening, what can I do? Nothing. And I happened to be in Sainsbury's, and I just went along and I was looking at the front pages of the paper, and there was that picture of the young terrorist, the one they were all after. And it was just this picture of a young Asian man, and I just burst into tears in Sainsbury's, got a few funny looks, because I just got in touch with the tragedy of what were the conditions that had led that young man to make decisions in his life that had taken him to that place where he had hurt so many people. It's, you know, so much tragedy on both sides. And actually, once I'd connected into the tragedy of it, it's like there was a pleasure in that connection that I could care about them. And there was a painfulness to the previous disconnection. But, you know, it's not like I was sort of happy about it or something like that. It's a deeper level of pleasure from connectedness. So the opposite of compassion, the far enemy, would be, you know, indifference, or like, you know, we just really don't care, you know, we just sort of harden to it. I think the near enemies, things that look like compassion but actually they aren't, are a lot more sort of prevalent, and it's quite, you know, I feel like I sort of fall into them all the time and then kind of hoik myself out, if you see what I mean. So the near enemies are pity, horrified anxiety, and anger and blame. And I'll go through them separately, but interestingly, what they all have in common is that in none of those emotions are we able to stay with our experience of painfulness. And it's not the other person's suffering we can't stay with, it's our own inability to stay with the painfulness in ourselves on meeting that suffering. So it's our own responses we can't stay with. So with pity, this is like the sort of sentimental one where it's like, you sort of think, you know, there's somebody sort of suffering and you think, oh, that's a shame, isn't it? What a pity. Wouldn't you like a cup of tea, dear? And there's a sort of separation to it, and quite often a looking down on that person, or like, oh yeah, that person's having a really hard time, aren't they? I got over that a couple of years ago. Or, you know, and you can feel that there's this sort of distance, and it's a bit sugary, and can feel like underneath you're happy it's not you. So that's pity. Horrified anxiety, a very big one. And this really can look like compassion. Very often, I think, you know, in the media, this is what, you know, people might think is compassion. And it's the kind of, it's awful, this is completely unbearable, this is terrible, let's fix it. And so what that is that's us not being able to stay with the level of painfulness. It's too unbearable, we cannot stay with it. But in a funny kind of way, it's like compassion is okay with suffering. That's a sort of funny thing to say when it's like it's totally trying to alleviate it. But like the Buddha, when he met Kisa Gotami, he wasn't overwhelmed by her distress that she'd lost her child. It's like he could just see that there were conditions that had led to that, and that was the way it was. And was there something he could do about that? He'd have done it, but there wasn't. And he did the thing that he could do. So, it's like compassion responds to the situation, but not with panic, not with a sort of desperate, I can't bear this. I don't know if you can get a flavour of that in your own experience. I think one of the clearest examples I had of it for myself was when I was working on the spinal injuries unit, which was the last physio job I had before I moved to Tararuaka. And everyone on that unit had a devastating injury. And most of the people, it's like I could hold, you know, my own response wasn't getting in the way. And I could hold the level of their distress, and we'd, you know, and it was like physio is never going to fix somebody's spine again. And yet you're doing the thing that is going to help that person have the best possible life they can have, given the level of their injury. But there was just this one young man, and he had a spinal injury at his neck level. And for whatever reason, it's like I just couldn't stay with my level of distress. And he'd just say, I just want to pick up my daughter one more time. She was about 3. And, you know, I knew, I'd seen his scans, he was never going to use his arms again. He was never going to have any feeling below the neck. And I just, you know, I absolutely couldn't stay with it. And what it meant was I couldn't relate to him directly as a person. And I could just feel that I was sliding off, and I sort of couldn't quite look him in the eye. And I just couldn't be present in the way that I was for my other patients, because I couldn't stay with my level of horrified anxiety around what had happened to him. So it actually gets in the way of our ability to respond. So then we've got anger and blame. So this is the response where we meet suffering in the world, and then we say, and it's their fault, and something should be done about it, and they should do it, and if it's not them, it's them. And then we can have all sorts of arguments about which sets of them it is. The other direction it can go actually is into ourselves, and it's sort of like self-blame, like, oh, I don't know, climate change is my fault because I still drive my car, or something like that. So it can go in or out. And it's a very culturally strong form at the moment. You know, look for the blame. As soon as, you know, if you open a paper, the first thing is going to be, who should we blame for this? And I mean, actually, anger is a completely natural response to pain. It, you know, and it is a response that will arise. And it's just this frustration of, like, we do not want it to be that way. We do not want it. But in the same way as with horrified anxiety and pity, it's like it's sliding off our experience. So our experience is, this is painful. This is really, really painful. And we're not able to stay with it. We're just sliding off and going, well, I can get rid of the pain if I just blame them. Or them. So there's quite a culturally strong belief at the moment that anger gets things done. That, you know, nothing gets done unless we get angry about it. Anger shows you care. Now, what I would argue is love shows you care. And anger is fueled by that love, that you wish it were different and it isn't. It might be quite, the whole question of anger and blame is probably too large for me to go into in this talk, but it might be quite an interesting question for each of you to sort of think, do I personally think anger is helpful? Like, in my personal relationships, is it helpful when I get angry with someone? Or is it helpful when I manage to have a conversation with them about that thing that I find difficult, where I'm making my points, but actually I'm not angry? I know quite a lot of people actually who they've either worked in the charitable sector, or for, you know, NGOs, or, you know, overseas aid, or, you know, all manner of different things. And I've met quite a lot of bitter and frustrated people who've spent their lives trying to getting angry about social issues, and then they come out the other end. Yeah, there's one particular woman who was, she was a director of one of the major NGOs, and she just resigned, and she came to Tararuaka on a metta retreat, and she said, if you knew how they treated me, if you knew how they people treat each other in that organisation, no one should be treated as people treat each other in that organisation. And if you knew which organisation it was, you would feel the irony of it even more. So, anger can get things done, and it tends to have a wider fallout as well. So we can just think about that. We can just think about whether we think anger gets things done. So we've got the final verse of the one of the first verses in the Dhammapada. Hatred never ceases by hatred. It only ceases by love. That is the eternal law. And it is a good one to reflect on, because in a way, we sort of believe it and then we sort of don't. So, yeah. And quite often, what happens is we oscillate between the near enemies of compassion. You know, we sort of flip between pity, anxiety and blame, and sort of kind of like a bit of a sort of swingometer. And quite often where we end up can be despair or numbness or giving up, or just thinking, I can't do this. I'm really angry. I'm going to sort out the world. Oh, no, actually, I'm just going to kind of try and live a happy life myself. I'm sorry other people suffer, but hey ho. So how do we have a creative response to suffering, given that we've just gone through three examples that aren't a creative response to suffering necessarily? So I think there's a couple of particular points about this, which all sort of stem from realizing that suffering cannot be fixed on its own level. So first, it's quite easy to sort of get stuck in a bit of a sort of ping pong between feeling like this particular issue has to be completely solved or completely fixed. You know, there has to be a solution. And then seeing that that's not going to happen, like we're not going to take suffering out of the world, and then flipping the other way into thinking, actually what I do has no effect. There's nothing I can do to make an impact on this. So it's a sort of all or nothing type thinking. And I think that can be quite undermining. For after all, you know, we've got all manner of fantastic people in the world, like, I don't know, Nelson Mandela made a huge difference to South Africa, and yet South Africa is not a perfect state. The Buddha lived and died, made a fantastic influence on so many different people in so many different parts of the world, so many cultures, and yet suffering is not completely eradicated. But he made an incredibly positive difference. So the other aspect of realising that suffering can't be fixed on its own level is that, in a way, we live in a world that is impermanent. We are impermanent, other beings are impermanent, and there will be suffering as long as we've still got greed and hatred and delusion, and I see me as separate, and I want this, and I don't want that, and I'm going to fight you for it. As long as those tendencies are present in people's minds, suffering will always be being created, no matter what political solutions, charitable initiatives happen. And those are fantastic and definitely need to happen. And yet, suffering is not going to be fixed on that level. So it's like sort of seeing the reality to it. So every time I get angry, in a way I've got the seed of every war in the world, every terrorist act in the world, in my own mind. And can I work with that, and can that have an effect? And in a way, that changing minds is going to be the thing that has the most lasting effect. So now we're coming round to Avalokiteshvara again. So I feel Avalokiteshvara is such a powerful figure because what he does is he holds this tension between our desire to engage with the world, this innate desire that other beings don't suffer and that we don't suffer, and we really want that to happen. And this sort of realization that, and we can't fix it. And it's like those two things are held together. And that particularly comes out in the thousand-armed form of Avalokiteshvara, which I'm not going to go into because Kate is going to do that tomorrow night. So I'm particularly talking about the four-armed form. And so it's like Avalokiteshvara is holding this tension. So he's got we've got this tension of wanting to fix the world and wanting to engage, and then also the tension of wanting to spiritually develop and change our own minds, and, you know, ourselves move towards our potential. And sometimes it can feel like that's withdrawal, you know, when we meditate or we go to the Buddhist centre for silent meditation day or something like that. And quite often we can feel the tension very strongly in our own lives. So, recently I was doing a day in Aberystwyth with Anne and Laura and the rest of that Aberystwyth Sangha. Or I could have been on a climate change march. And I couldn't have done both things with that day. And quite often we'll feel like a very visceral tension within ourselves that for us to be, to nourish ourselves, we need time on our own, we need time doing nothing, being creative, looking at the sky, going for a walk, something like that. Or we could be doing our neighbour's shopping, or we could be putting the tea out at the Buddhist centre, or we could be engaging with the world. So that's like a tension that probably all of us live in different ways. And different people will have a different balance in the various directions. And we can think with a tension like that, that what we're trying to do is we're trying to get the perfect balance. We're trying to get it right between helping the world and looking after our own well-being. Now, what Sangharakshita says about this is that we can't get a balance because it's not possible. And that tension is a creative tension. And out of that tension, that's where true compassion is going to happen. So it's not that we either need to engage or we need to withdraw. It's that we have to do both, and we have to do both even more strongly until that tension is so strong that there stops being a split between what we want and what other people want. But I think for most of us, most of the time, it's just a matter of realising that both those aspects of our lives are crucially important. And we would seriously have lost something if we lost either side of the tension. Now, part of the tension sort of comes from a bit of a misunderstanding of thinking that when we do things for somebody else, it's like that takes from us. We're losing something if we give to other people. And whereas if we sort of have me time and do things for ourselves, well, that's sort of stealing from other people. We're not kind of giving to other people if we're giving to ourselves. However, the Dharma life suggests that neither of those is quite the case, and that's what we're going to unpack next. In a way, you can probably all just tell that by coming on a work retreat, because like here you are doing external activity. So you're giving to Taraloka, you're giving to all those women that come to Taraloka, maybe stressed out lives. Maybe it's their first contact with meditation or the Dharma. How many women come to Taraloka over the course of a year or over the course of the 30 years of its history? And you are giving to all those women that are going to come and walk through the grounds, inhabit this space, enjoy the beauty. So there you are being generous. And I would also hope that you're gaining from it yourselves and you're also enjoying it. And there's a sort of sense of connection in you which is pleasant and is also causing you to grow spiritually by feeling that sense of connection. So in a way, you can. Sometimes I have people say about work retreats, "Oh, I'm ever so sorry. I just came because I wanted to enjoy it." And you sort of think, no, that's good. That's fine. I want you to enjoy it. You know, you're supposed to have a good time. You know, whereas like if they're not having a miserable time, they're obviously not being generous. And you sort of think, hang on a sec, folks. So it's not quite as simple as it might sound. So in the four-armed Avalokiteshvara, we've got his outer arms and they're reaching out to the world. And so we've got one hand holding the lotus, holding the potential of every being, every situation. No matter how hopeless that situation looks, there's always the potential for change and there's always the potential for that person to grow, become happier, whatever. And then there's the mala in the circle where, you know, he's just keeping on, keeping going through his mantra and sort of never giving up. So I'm going to kind of come a bit more practically now and talk about like particular ways we could sort of think about engagement and then about withdrawal. So first of all, engagement in the Sangha. So I think I particularly want to say that the Sangha is also the world. So people come to Taraloka and they sort of say, yes, well, in the real world, or I'm going back to the real world. And you sort of think, well, where are we then? Are we not real? Is this not real? If you come to Taraloka, is that not real? So actually, it's like, you know, Sangharakshita has talked about Buddhist centres. As a, you know, somebody sort of said, oh, why aren't you doing more social activities? And he said, well, the Buddhist centres are for the existential casualties. So, you know, we've got all different, you know, groups, Buddhist centres, individuals, and generally a lot of people come in contact with meditation and with the Dharma. And if you just think about what that has done for you in your life, and then you think about how that's going out to other people in their lives, that is compassionate activity. So my old centre, Sheffield, where Kate and Claire are from, so they're having about 130 people on each beginner's course. And, you know, those beginner's courses, you know, they you know, there's one and then another few months later, there's another and there's another and there's another. And you just think how much of the population of Sheffield that is touching. I mean, in the end, they're going to get everyone, aren't they? And actually, you know, all the different groups and, you know, wherever we are in the Sangha, it's like it's all spreading out to different people. Apparently there's even a parliamentary group on mindfulness, MPs interested in mindfulness. It's like, so, yes. So do rejoice in having an effect in the world. It's like here and now is valid. One of the things I sometimes think is like, you know, they never report there was an outbreak of happiness in North Shropshire. No, you know, they never consider it, do they? You know, but if it was an outbreak of, I don't know, the Black Plague or an earthquake or something like that, it would be like the front page of the Times. You know, outbreak of happiness, it never makes it. So I suppose what I'm saying is don't underestimate what the Sangha gives to the world. Like, everyone that comes to the Sangha is just as real as a Syrian refugee. So then engagement in the world more generally. So these are mainly tips to avoid overwhelm, okay? So cultivate pleasure and a belief that your choices produce positive effects. So if you buy a carton of fair trade orange juice, reflect on that. And, you know, like usually there's a thing on the side telling you something about the people that you've chosen to help. And don't just think, oh, that's marketing. Think, I've made a choice to help somebody growing, I don't know, oranges in Guyana or something like that. And, you know, because you've made that choice, that family can give its children enough food to eat. They can probably give them an education. They can have clean water in their village, or, you know, whatever it might be in that situation. We're not directly in contact with that effect, but yet, by our choice, we have made that effect. So it's like sort of try and focus on the positive effects that your decisions have made. And this is just sensible, okay? Because basically what happens is, if something is pleasurable, it means we want to move towards it, and it means we want to repeat that action. If we buy a carton of orange juice and we feel really miserable that everything else we've put in our trolley isn't fair trade, we're going to feel aversion to that whole experience, and we're not going to want to go near it. Okay, so it's a good thing to do on a lot of levels. If you can't get in contact with your direct effect in an ethical choice, it can be helpful just to think of it the other way around and think, who do I want to be? So I think this about flying, for instance. It's like, I can't really get in touch with, if I buy an airline ticket, that's going to make the slightest difference to climate change. Even though, if enough people did, it would make a difference to climate change. But I can do that on the basis of, actually, I do not want to be doing actions that are harming this planet. I just don't want to do that. And so I can do it on that basis, if you see what I mean. So you can just sort of look and see what thought motivates you most. What thought takes you into a positive relationship with that thing. Don't scorn the small things. Send a card to your depressed friend. You know, one sleeping bag to the refugees is one more refugee with a sleeping bag. One fair trade chocolate bar is, you know, don't, you know, just think yes, and then delight in each action that you do. And if you've a particular issue or a particular area you've an interest in, you know, do take it to your Sangha, see if you can run an event around it or something like that. You know, that'll be your contribution. The Sangha is just like, you know, we're all just participating in this work retreat. We're all participating in making Tara Loka happen. And the Sangha is no different. We make it happen. Make conscious choices. So this is to sort of avoid the whole sort of overwhelm, I can't bear to look at it, so I'm not. So choose to change your electricity supplier to a green electricity supplier, or decide you can't afford it, or actually you've got so much going on in your life right now you just can't think about it, and make a conscious decision you're not going to think about it for another 6 months, and just decide, okay, I've thought about that, that's what I'm doing. Tara Loka has just gone on to Ecotricity, hooray! And if you do change your electricity supplier to a green one, then rejoice in it. Tell everybody. Be happy about it. And see if we can cultivate an attitude of engaging with the world to benefit ourselves. Engaging with the world as an act of connectedness, which makes us feel more whole. Okay, so now we're on to Avalokiteshvara's inner arms. So he's got these arms out in the world, and he's got these other arms that hold a jewel to his heart. And he's got his hands in that Anjali mudra, which is like that. So that's, you know, what we do when we salute the shrine. It's not a sort of prayer position, it's holding this jewel to our heart, and that's what we're signifying when we do that. And that jewel that Avalokiteshvara is holding is a wish-fulfilling jewel, the Chintamani. And for Avalokiteshvara, that's the bodhicitta. So the bodhicitta is the heart or mind of enlightenment, the will to enlightenment for our own sake and all beings. And it's like a desire that everyone be well and happy and fulfill their potential. It's like the altruistic aspect of enlightenment. And we don't have to worry about whether or not that is what we have at our hearts, because actually we are all connected whether we like it or not. So the reason we do care about suffering in the world is because we are connected and we do want beings to be well. So that is just there under everything. Even if, you know, at any given moment we're not necessarily in touch with it. But how we could maybe think about it is, do we live from our deepest values? Do we live from what we genuinely think is important in the world? So the only reason that Avalokiteshvara can do this endless reaching out into the world is because he never loses touch with what is most important to him and what is most dear to him. And those values could be slightly different for different people. And we don't have to worry about those differences because they will all be rooted in connectedness. So, for instance, someone might have a value of kindness. You know, they want to, you know, you want to hold kindness to your heart. When you die, when you're on your deathbed, what would you like people to say about your life? What would you like people to have said? Oh, yes, she embodied that in her life, or she lived from that. So for somebody it might be kindness, and actually if you want kindness for yourself, you want it for others. If it's authenticity, you want to be able to live an authentic life for yourself, and you want other people to be able to live authentically. If it's beauty, you want a beautiful life for yourself, you also want beauty in the world and for others. It's like all these values will be universal and will connect us. So in the shrine room afterwards, we're going to do a bit of a reflection about what value might we want to live from and never lose? What might we want to hold to our hearts? And that is what sustains the external activity. So apart from anything, what this is talking about is the crucial importance of our own personal practice. So if we are not changing ourselves and growing and developing spiritually, actually we're not going to be in a state ourselves to affect the world positively, or at any rate, not as positively as we could do if we were coming from a more positive place. So, and maybe we could each just think about how that is in our lives as well. So what does happen when we lose touch with our own potential, our own values? What does happen when we lose touch with our own spiritual practice? And kind of check out for yourselves, like, is that actually true? Do I function better in the world when I'm truly in touch with my own spirituality or not? You know, open question, do come to your own conclusions. So how can we keep that link? So for me, that is meditation. And I know it's not the case for everyone, but personally, I keep it by meditation. When we chant the refuges and precepts, it's making that connection. It could be a mantra. It could be a particular Buddha or Bodhisattva figure. It could be every day we go out and look at the sky. It could be we do artwork. It could be we write poetry. You know, there's umpteen different ways. But like, how do we contact our own potential, our own creativity? Now, it's really easy to think, how does our own practice affect the world? And I can think of this too. So I'm just going to tell you a little story. And this is when I was working in Sheffield, in the hospital. And one day, a woman that I worked with, an occupational therapist, she came into work about 2 or 3 hours late, and she said, "I've been stuck in a traffic jam all the way from Leeds." And it was just like, you know, we were just solid on the motorway. And she said, and I thought, normally I'd get really frustrated by this, but I thought to myself, what would Ginny do? And I turned the radio up full volume and I opened the windows and I sang out loud. And I sort of thought, I probably wouldn't have done anything like that. But the point was, and the thing was, like, I'd been practicing the Dharma about 2 years at that point. She knew I went to the Buddhist centre, but as far as I remember, I don't think we'd ever had a conversation about the Dharma, ever, as far as I can remember. And yet, there was, I was completely taken aback, because there was obviously something in the way that I was in my work that had made her think, what would Ginny do? And that had made her think, I could have a creative response to this situation. And so basically, like, you never know. We're all having an effect on each other all of the time. We can't avoid it. And actually, you won't know how much of an effect you're having on the people around you, unless you have a random incident like that and you think, oh, okay then. So actually, we do affect other people, the world, by how we are. So Sangharakshita says, the Bodhisattva benefits people by inspiring them, by sparking them off, by communicating to them the emotional positivity, the creativity and the excitement, the sheer adventure of the spiritual life. The Bodhisattva is like a candle which lights thousands upon thousands of other candles, after which they go on burning with their own fuel. Not only that, all of them in turn light thousands upon thousands of other candles. So part of helping others is keeping our own inspiration alive, because how can we light up other people if we can't light up ourselves? So think of our own practice as altruism. When I meditate, I do that for the benefit of other people. It's much more motivating. It's like cooking for yourself. When you cook for yourself, you can't be bothered. If you cook for other people, you cook something really nice, don't you? It's the same with meditation, okay? So try thinking of it like that and see what happens. So I think my final point about our own practice is, don't worry about how you're going to benefit other people. See, can we just cultivate the desire to relieve suffering and cultivate the desire to benefit other people? And actually, like, don't worry about how that's going to pan out, because actually the other regarding actions will just happen. They will just kind of arise. And just don't put limits on what that might look like. Just open to how it could be. So I'll finish with a quote from Sangharakshita. So he says, in the traditional formulation of the first Bodhisattva vow, one says, I vow to save all living beings. What one is really saying is, I place no limit on what I am prepared to do for other living beings, when the time is ripe and I am ready. One doesn't know what form one's aspiration is ultimately going to take, or what one may need to do. One just remains open to helping people in whatever way one can.